Good evening. My name is Dave Emery, and it is my special privilege to be joined this evening by three eminent guests, all of them authors, all of them, in my opinion, also heroes, three gentlemen who have taken it upon themselves to plumb the depths of untruth, to attempt to shed some light on in some very dark corners of medical and political history, and three men to whom many members of the listening audience may wind up owing far more than they might suspect at first. First of all, it is my honor and privilege to introduce Dr. Alan Cantwell, the author of AIDS and the Doctors of Death, among other titles. Alan, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you.
And if you could speak just a little louder and closer to the mic, please, Alan.
Okay, how's this?
Excellent. And Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, subtitled AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional. Len, welcome to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
And Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory. Ed, welcome once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
And, by the way, the publishers on these books, Emerging Viruses, published by Tetrahedron. We're going to tell you at the end of tonight's program where to get these books. AIDS and the Doctors of Death by Ares Rising Press. And Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus by Wordsworth Press. Gentlemen, I guess one could say in introducing all three of your books, books which have significant areas of convergence, a few areas of divergence, but all of which I think could be said to relate to a term that, Len, you coined in your book, Emerging Viruses, where you talked about the medical, military, industrial complex. And I think one of the factors that all of your books have in common is that you have determined that the reservoir, so to speak, of a number of diseases, ranging from, in your case, Ed, a soft tissue cancer epidemic and possibly AIDS. In your case, Len, AIDS and possibly Ebola and Marburg. And in your case, Alan Cantwell, AIDS. That the reservoir for all of these diseases lies in laboratories created by Homo sapiens. Basically, whether accident or intentional, and there is a debate and some divergence of opinion on all of these things, that these diseases were created intentionally and or otherwise in laboratories. Would you say that's a fair common foundation for all of your works?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
What I'm going to ask you to do next is to take about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes, what are you in that time frame, and sum up each of your books. Ed, in some ways, your book occurs first on a timeline. Why don't you begin?
Oh, I was hoping to go third.
You want? we can do that too.
You're in a hot seat, Ed.
Yeah.
Let's go.
No, we can do that. If you'd prefer to do that, we can do it.
Well, let me make a little bridge comment because I think I belong third in this sequence. But I mean, my story is a very narrow look at a very specific incident, and I think that's that underground medical laboratory that I've been investigating in New Orleans in the 1960s is a pivot point in a much larger story. And I think that Len Horowitz has done a terrific job of painting in the background of that from the perspective of the government's paper trail on what they've been doing in terms of medical research, I hesitate to even call it medical research, but certainly biochemical and living organism research over the last number of years, and how it fits into the policy development apparatus of the United States. And Dr. Alan Cantwell has done a terrific job of just waking people up in terms of the devious activities of the scientific community, and I think those are really the broad brush things that we should start with. And once they have set the stage for that, I think it'll be a lot easier for people to see where this particular medical laboratory that I'm interested in fits in from a historical context.
Okay, fair enough. That is the way we will do it then. This is Democratic Radio, if nothing else. So which of the two of you would like to begin here? We need a leadoff hitter.
Well, we decided already that Alan should go first.
Okay, Alan?
Ares Rising Press, right? Ares always goes first.
Okay, by the way, it might seem a little corny to listeners, but this is one of the things that non-commercial radio allows you to do. This is over-the-counter radio. This is no BS radio.
Well, first of all, my obsession with the origin of AIDS stemmed from some research, particularly into the subject of Kaposi sarcoma, which is the so-called gay cancer, which turned out to be the scarlet letter of AIDS and allowed AIDS to be identified as a new and unique disease affecting young gay men in the early 1980s. And when the AIDS epidemic was uncovered in 1981, I had been studying this tumor and had found some bacteria and had published my research in the medical journals. And I thought it was rather strange that for the few years that we were awaiting the discovery of the cause of AIDS, that this work was ignored. So when the AIDS virus was discovered in April 1984 by Dr. Robert Gallo, the so-called discoverer of the AIDS virus, and as many of your listeners know, that that was immediately challenged by Luc Montagnier of the Pasteur Institute, who felt that he was the discoverer of the AIDS virus. At any rate, I knew from the very beginning that the politics, particularly the scientific politics of AIDS, was very strange because there was absolutely no interest in my research, which did uncover an infectious agent, particularly in Kaposi sarcoma. I think that my obsession with AIDS reached its high mark in 1986 when I met Dr. Robert Strecker, who was one of the first American physicians to declare that AIDS was a man-made disease. And when I had the opportunity to meet him in the summer of 1986, one of my first questions to Dr. Robert Strecker was, okay, how did HIV, how did it become introduced into the gay community? And he quite simply told me, it's very simple, it was put there. And I said, it was put there? What are you talking about? And he said, well, you remember the hepatitis B vaccine experiment that began in New York City in 1978. And I said to him, well, I vaguely recall that. I'm a dermatologist. I don't get particularly involved with hepatitis. But he said, well, if you will go and you will study that experiment as well as study some other peculiarities about AIDS, you will, I think, come to the conclusion that AIDS is a man-made disease. Well, of course, this was very depressing, and I recall not sleeping very well that night and becoming very angry and determined to prove that Dr. Strecker was wrong. And so over a period of months of avid research into this area, as well as with the basis of my own work in cancer bacteria with Kaposi sarcoma and other forms of cancer, I did come to the conclusion that Dr. Strecker was correct, and my research, I wrote it up and tried to present it very simply, and it was incorporated into my book, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, which was published in 1988, and was a very successful book on some levels in that it was so successful in terms of upsetting people that when it was to be sold at a bookstore at the AIDS International Conference in Montreal in 1989, the World Health officials asked the booksellers very, very nicely but emphatically to please take that book off their shelves. So I realized then that that this book was making a lot of waves and obviously upsetting the medical establishment. But the basis of the book tries to explain to people very clearly how HIV came out of cancer research, in particularly animal cancer research with animal viruses, which were which were taken from one animal and put into another animal, or taken from an animal cancer and then put into tissue cell cultures from various tissues of other animals and then eventually into human tissue. And in the process of doing this, it is my contention that this gave birth to the AIDS virus. And, of course, It's not only this kind of thinking, but an awareness of some of the documentation. For instance, the testimony before Congress in 1969, where the Department of Defense paid $10 million to develop what they called a super germ that was to be developed by the medical and biologic institutions. And this super germ was to be used as a biological warfare agent, and it was to be a germ that had never before been known to occur in nature, but would be a germ that would be so powerful that the immune system of people would be powerless against. So it seemed to me that virus, which was to be produced within a decade, actually was produced within a decade. And it seems to me that one representation of this supervirus could be the so-called HIV virus, which was introduced into the gay population in 1979. And the introduction of HIV into the gay population in 1979 followed very closely on the heels of the hepatitis B vaccine experiment. This vaccine experiment first took place in November 1978. It employed 1,000 gay men. The men in the experiment had to be gay. The experimenter did not want any straight men in the experiment. He wanted only promiscuous gay or bisexual men. He wanted men who were healthy. He wanted men who were well-educated. He preferred white men, particularly men that had an address, a phone number, and that who could deposit blood over a period of time. So 1,000 men were finally selected. These were perfectly healthy men. And the injections began, and over the next year, the men received their injections. And then in 1980, a new experiment began in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, St. Louis, and Chicago. These were all done under the auspices of the CDC, the Public Health Service, the National Institute of Health, blah, blah, blah. And this was a very important vaccine experiment, which was very, very successful. And what happened is, a few months after the vaccine experiments began, the first few cases of AIDS started to trickle in New York City in 1979. All the men were gay, they were white, they were well-educated, they were all previously healthy, so that you can clearly see that the profile of the men in the hepatitis B vaccine trial closely resembled the men who initially came down with AIDS as part of the epidemic. And the epidemic was quickly labeled a gay disease. Within a period of years, AIDS was, it was told to the American public that AIDS came from Africa. And I think most of your listeners probably, Dave, don't believe the green monkey story. And we've talked about that over this weekend repeatedly.
And we'll talk about it again later this evening.
Yeah, but certainly I would like to explain to your listeners that because I do not believe in the African origin of American AIDS at all, and I feel that that green monkey story was promoted by the government scientists who were intricately involved in the AIDS establishment, and that this story was perpetrated to put the blame on Africans and to cover up the real story about the origin of AIDS, which came out of animal cancer viral research. And Dr. Horowitz will go into that, I'm sure, in great detail. And I also want to say that, yes, I do believe that there's an AIDS epidemic in Africa, although there's some people who claim it doesn't exist there. And when you trace AIDS back in Africa, there is evidence that AIDS quickly followed as a result of massive vaccine programs sponsored by the World Health Organization, which injected millions of blacks as late as 1977. And as most people who are aware of vaccine experimentation know, especially black people, many, many vaccines are tested in Africa. And today at another meeting, we talked about the story that appeared on the front page of the London Times on May 11th, 1987, where the science writer declared that a World Health official, World Health Organization health advisor had done a study, and he was convinced that the smallpox vaccine eradication program had something to do with a tremendous outbreak of AIDS in Africa, and that they had felt that the vaccine program had possibly awakened a dormant HIV virus, and that allowed HIV to come to the fore and to start the severe epidemic of AIDS in Africa. So in summary, my books go into detail on cancer experimentation, and they go into detail as to the hepatitis B vaccine program. They go into detail about previous biological warfare experimentation, and certainly as time goes by, I think more and more people are aware that there are citizens throughout the world who secretly can be experimented on, and that includes not just black people and gay people, but white people. Certainly we've become aware just a little bit of the radiation experiments that took place on unsuspecting American citizens starting in the 1940s into the 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, where we take a healthy young man and we inject him with plutonium, for instance, which is guaranteed, you know, to kill people. So when I first started this work, people sort of went, ho-hum, I don't believe it a bit. But now I think as time goes by, we see more and more peculiarities in the science of AIDS, and that is because, in my view, the roots of AIDS stem from a cancer virus experimentation, an experimentation that was covert, and because the education of AIDS stems from roots that, as far as I'm concerned, are poisoned with biological warfare overtones, it seems to me now we are bearing the fruit of some really insane science, and we are tonight we'll be talking about things like the Persian Gulf syndrome, which is another thing that some people are totally convinced is a genetically engineered a disease, either caused by the Iraqis or caused by us, or caused by us because we sold biological warfare weapons to Saddam Hussein and he in turn delivered them to our soldiers, or the other possibility is that our soldiers were all given experimental vaccines, sometimes forcibly against their will. And we will talk over and over again tonight about vaccine programs and how dangerous they can be in terms of if these vaccines are contaminated either accidentally or deliberately, that these can produce holocausts of unconceivable proportions. So with that, I think I will that's a teaser for your listeners, but it sort of gives you my view as to why I believe that AIDS is a man-made disease and the research that went into that.
I would point out that your books came out in the 1980s, and that as a publisher on the subject, you were something of a pioneer, and this audience has become familiar with your work way back in the 80s, and some of your work was incorporated into supplements of a archive show I did that over an increment in increments, basically called AIDS: Epidemic or Weapon of War. And so you were, in a publishing sense, something of a pioneer, one of the individuals who walked point in terms of advancing what I believe is a valid, although certainly very controversial, theory concerning AIDS. We might want to bear in mind, too, the ancient Turkish or the old Turkish proverb that he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And Dr. Campbell, you deserve a lot of credit for being one of the first to be willing to be so chased.
Right.
Who was it said, let me be chased, but not now. And Len, you also have done work on cancer research, vaccines, and some of the things that have come out of them, possibly in unforeseen or possibly things that were deliberately created in a clandestine fashion.
Right. Well, I guess taking off where Alan left off, it was that Department of Defense appropriations request for 1970 funding for the sum of $10 million for a five-year study to develop immune system ravaging viruses for germ warfare, which got me started on a three-year investigation into the origin of AIDS and Ebola. And ultimately, it led me to the publication of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, in which the readers will learn that that was essentially Henry Kissinger's order to Melvin Laird. When Kissinger took over as National Security Advisor under Richard Nixon in 1968, he almost immediately ordered Laird to do a reassessment of America's biological weapons capabilities. And when he then got the information, he selected the option of developing these immune system ravaging viruses. And this $10 million I ultimately tracked to an organization, very local, Dave, called Litton Bionetics, which is a subsidiary of the mega military weapons contractor called Litton Industries. Now, interestingly enough, when Nixon was selecting Kissinger as NSC advisor, he was looking also at the possibility of selecting Roy Ashe, the president of Litton, for that post.
By the way, we might want to note that not only is Litton a major defense contractor, but has been a vehicle for covert actions in the past.
Interesting. Well, so what they did now, and how I fell into this, was the World Health Organization, as Alan had stated, was suspected by Dr. Gallo and others as being the route upon which the AIDS virus was developed and or deployed. So I began by investigating that theory by just going into World Health Organization Chronicle reports that I was able to dig up at Harvard's Countway Library. And I went through 1965 through 75 reviewing those reports, and I found that they had developed a viral research network that literally was able to isolate and or create over 70,000 viruses by 1970, and that they had used four principal agencies to distribute these viruses to well over 500 other research laboratories throughout the world. The four principal agencies included the Centers for Disease Control and the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda. And the NCI was actually the principal depository and principal distribution site. So at that point, I began to suspect Dr. Robert Gallo. Now, why would I do that? Well, I had heard all sorts of things. He was a notorious fellow who apparently had either discovered or co-discovered or allegedly stole the virus from Dr. Luc Montagnier, and I wasn't certain about him. I heard lots of things. I began to suspect him just because he was the chief retrovirologist associated with the National Cancer Institute. So I figured I'd better go into Harvard's Countway Library again and dig up Gallo's entire research reports, all of them from 1967 through 1974. There were about 40-some-odd, and I buried myself in a room for about 3 weeks and didn't come out, and evaluated each and every paper several times. And what I learned was actually astonishing. What I learned was that they had taken monkey viruses, for example, that were completely humanly benign. They could barely hurt monkeys. And that they then recombined these with virtually every cancer virus under the sun. And in the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, I literally reprinted their entire list of viruses, and even the virologist that I showed this to at the International Conference on AIDS in Vancouver on July 10th, they couldn't believe it. It was just amazing, the recombinants. Well, at any rate, they had taken, for example, monkey viruses, recombined them with cat leukemia, chicken leukemia, sarcoma. This caused immune suppression, wasting, and death. Feline leukemia virus, of course, many of your listeners can know this, that it causes a laundry list of symptoms virtually identical to what the AIDS patients suffer from. And then, even at this point, this virus could not infect humans. To get it to jump species, it needed another major mutation. And in order to accomplish that, what they did is they cultured it in human white blood cells in some studies and human fetal tissue cells in other studies so that it would literally adapt, creating the little proteins, the GP120-like proteins on the outside membrane of the AIDS virus that allows it to attach to the human cell membranes, be carried across the cell membranes, enter the gene of the cell, and then essentially do everything that the AIDS virus does. Now, I noticed that they published this, and I noticed that about 20%, maybe 30% of Gallo's reports he had published with co-authors from Litton Bionetics. And at the time, I didn't know what Litton Bionetics was. I kept looking around for some information about it, and ultimately I found in the congressional record that Litton Bionetics was sixth on the list of major Army biological weapons contractors at that time. And then I found a very interesting footnote in one of Dr. Gallo's papers with Bionetics researchers that they presented their research in front of NATO military scientists in Mol, Belgium. And so on July 10th, the evening that after I presented my paper and I had the great honor to be the first researcher or investigator in the history of the International AIDS Conference to actually present a paper saying that these viruses are certainly man-made, the laboratory creations. And that night, I had gone to Dr. Gallo's open forum, and at that time, in front of 300 people in the media, I asked Dr. Gallo, I was standing on the microphone, I said, Dr. Gallo, are you concerned at all that your early research might have led to the creation of the AIDS virus or its AIDS virus progenitors, and that through vaccine contamination from monkeys supplied by Litton Bionetics researchers, your colleagues, which had been sent to Merck Sharp and Dohme, which were used to develop the experimental hepatitis B vaccine that was administered simultaneously in 1974 in Central Africa on blacks and on Willowbrook State School mentally retarded children on Staten Island in New York, as well as most plausibly gay men in New York City. And actually today we had some confirmation that indeed the gay men in New York were experimented on with that 1974 vaccine. Dave, you missed that this afternoon. We had that. We just learned that from
a different light bookstore. There was a fellow there that told Len about his experiences.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. So up until this point, I only speculated. The speculation was based on a lot of circumstantial evidence, but we got confirmation of that this afternoon.
Fantastic.
Yes.
So, but we'll get into that in some of the subsequent discussion.
Right. So at any rate, Gallo flipped out. He got very angry with me. In essence, he told me that I need to go get a grade 101 level of biological science training, high school level, that it was impossible to do this work that I'm saying that he did. And meanwhile, we have the paper trail, and we have the documentation that proves it.
One thing we might want to note, strictly for legal purposes, is that Dr. Gallo has certainly not been charged with any kind of crime or faced with any kind of legal proceeding. Also, we should note that with regard to covert actions, because we're going to get into the institutions you've already been mentioning, such as Merck, Sharp and Dohme, Litton, and so forth, heavily overlap the defense establishment. And again, the term I used earlier and that you coined in your book, the medical military industrial complex, I think is relevant. Frequently within the realm of national security research, people will do academic research simply in order to penetrate the realm of truth concerning the physical sciences, not knowing how their work will be used. And also, when you're talking about biological warfare, it doesn't take a great many people to transport or manipulate these things, given their size. And with regard to covert actions in general, all participants are dealt with on a need-to-know basis.
Exactly. So, at any rate, Dr. Gallo was very angry with me. The next day, he happened to see the fact that my co-author on Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, the fellow who wrote the foreword to the book, was John Martin, W. John Martin, MD, PhD, one of the world's leading vaccine contamination analysts, a personal friend of Dr. Gallo, who literally ran the FDA's Bureau of Biologics in charge of testing human vaccines between 1976 and 1980. And then he happened to see a testimonial that Garth Nicholson, one of your guests later on tonight, had given me, which basically said, I've contributed very well to science and to humanity for the publication of this book. And that he called Garth Nicholson because Nicholson, it was a good friend of his, and also they had both worked under the Special Virus Cancer Program and had some involvements with Fort Detrick. So he said to Nicholson something to the effect, and I guess Garth can tell you what he said more clearly, but The way it was relayed to me was that, you know, what are you doing giving Horowitz a good testimonial like this? Obviously, the guy is like a lunatic, and what the heck are you doing? So Nicholson said something to the effect that, oh, well, first of all, he's no lunatic. He's a Harvard grad. And second of all, Bob, have you read his book? And he said, no. And he says, Bob, you better read his book. So here's his number. So on July 30th, my phone rings. He says, this is Gallo. And it started a 35-minute conversation wherein Dr. Gallo actually says he cannot argue in general with a thesis. And he however, raises five objections. Actually, there were only two major objections. One was the fact that he said that it was impossible, for example, to combine cat leukemia and chicken sarcoma viruses, that you can't do that, he says, because the homology was different. Meanwhile, that is absolutely false and totally misleading. In fact, A, he did it with his groups of researchers, and B, all his mentors actually came out and published that it was possible to do this research and that it was being done. And, in fact, the specific text that talks about biological weapons, the most definitive biological weapons text, published by Oxford University Press, contributed by David Baltimore, who was the principal pioneer in molecular genetics and molecular biology, he says, yes, indeed, this type of work was being done for biological weapons development between 1965 and 1975. And that's the second thing that Gallo says. He says, no, we couldn't have done it. And this is what your listeners are really truly getting something tonight, right now, that they will not get anywhere else. The fact of the matter is they're going to hear time and time again that it's impossible for them to have produced the AIDS virus between 65 and 75 because Gallo said, no, we couldn't have done it because the molecular genetics engineering technology did not exist. Well, the truth is that Alexander Graham Bell did not need fiber optics to make his first telephone call. And the fact of the matter is that they were doing this in a very sloppy, haphazard manner. They were literally pulling together these different viruses, these different cancer viruses, and most incredibly, the specific cancer complex that they were focusing on between 1962 and 1976 during this special virus cancer program that Dr. Cantwell had talked about was the leukemia, lymphoma, sarcoma cancer complex that never existed in the human species. Never, absolutely never existed until 1978 with the advent of AIDS, where we saw this cancer complex associated with the immune dysfunction. And that's exactly what they were producing in their labs at that time. Now, how do I know this? Ultimately, I dug up the contracts. At the end of the book Emerging Viruses, or close to the end of it, I found the contracts. It was an incredible experience. I wrote about how I found them. It was a miracle because they had been pulled off of the libraries. If you go into a library today and you put the subject title, book title, Special Virus Cancer Program, Authors, NCI Staff, you know, nothing will come up. You'll get a blank title. The title will come up, but it'll show you there's not available. It's not available. They pulled it off the library catalogs, and I found it in the basement of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill Public Library. It was a public library, Davis Library, in the government's documents office, and that contained all of the people that were involved, what they were doing, their contracts, even their addresses and telephone numbers. And so that's where I found the contract under which AIDS-like and Ebola-like viruses were being developed by Litton Bionetics. I found the contract which showed that Litton Bionetics was the chief supplier of all the monkeys, all the monkey viruses, all the monkey virus cell lines and the reagents associated with every aspect of monkey virus cancer research and biological weapons development, and that ultimately I found that Litton Bionetics and Dr. Robert Gallo had been paid approximately $2,153,000 per year to develop these types of viruses. And that then answered my initial question, how was it that the National Academy of Sciences knew to tell the Department of Defense in 1968 that it would take 5 years at $2 million a year for the development of these immune system ravaging viruses for germ warfare was the fact that they had just done it.
there are a number of institutions. Before we move on to Ed Haslam, by way of setting the stage for examining the vaccines, contamination of vaccines, and either unintentional or intentional dissemination of some of these diseases, the war on cancer that Richard Nixon declared, Litton Bionetics, Fort Detrick, the Special Viral Cancer Program, Jack Gruber, and Alfred Hellman, names that all overlap each other, the National Cancer Institute, and biological warfare.
Yes, indeed. I mean, those were the key players. Jack Gruber, on this contract we publish in Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, you see Dr. Gruber and Dr. Gallo were the NCI project officers on the Litton Bionetics Research Grant. And as you say, Jack Gruber's background is in Fort Detrick in biological weapons development and also at the NCI. You had Litton Bionetics connections both at Fort Detrick. Interestingly enough, their principal research laboratory was also in Northwest Uganda, associated with the International Association for Research in Cancer. And I also tracked the most plausible vaccine in which AIDS viruses were initially transmitted to the 1974 experimental hepatitis B vaccine that was conducted simultaneously in New York City and Central Africa. And for those listeners out there who read The Hot Zone, Richard Preston's The Hot Zone, where Preston said that these viruses emerged out of Kittim Cave in near northwest Uganda. Well, Kittim Cave, it turns out, is a metaphor for Litton Bionetics Research Laboratories, which was about 250 miles south of the actual Kittim Cave.
And Fort Detrick, well, maybe we should get into this a little later on in the discussion about how Fort Detrick figures in here. By the way, Alan, a couple of points, too. If you could help me remember later, because we're going to be ranging far and wide in this discussion, two of the points that I want to make sure to bring up about AIDS and the Doctors of Death, a very important individual, Wolf Schmunes, an individual who appears to have more connections than a switchboard. Also, Alan, you bring up the Tuskegee study, something that I think in terms of historical antecedents is important here, and something that also has a hard operational connection. Ed, you've been waiting patiently there, and you wanted to bat third, so we've got two men on and nobody out, and it's your turn to step to the plate. And again, if you could summarize the book, and then we'll range far and wide here and examine areas of overlap and divergence and convergence and maybe where we go from here.
Well, first of all, let me say I question the wisdom of my decision to bat third, because I had to sit here and listen to all that, and every time somebody said something, I had a comment I wanted to make, and I pretty much agreed with the vast majority of what I heard there. I want to start with a couple comments, and then I'll get into my book. First of all, both authors talked about the 1970 congressional testimony by Dr. MacArthur, and I really agree with Dr. Horowitz's analysis that statement was made after the work had already been done. And if it started the decade of work, I just wonder which decade of work it was. Secondly, I think the arguments that that AIDS is a man-made disease is a very good argument. I address it in my book, and I address it more on the work of Los Alamos Laboratories, where they measure the intrinsic error frequency rate of it using certain sophisticated genetic techniques, et cetera. But the arguments that it's man-made is a very serious scientific position, and I think it's a very reasonable position. How it was man-made is a different issue, and I think we can talk about it later. My story kind of traces back to the fact that I'm from New Orleans, and during that entire time I grew up, I kept hearing very strange rumors about a lot of strange stuff that was going on in town, and particularly people that were doing bizarre experiments with monkey viruses. And I was concerned about these experiments back in the 1960s. And in the late 1980s, when the mainstream American scientists, such as Max Essex out of Harvard, et cetera, started talking about HIV-1, or the AIDS virus, being a mutated monkey virus, it sounded awfully familiar to me, because it sounded like the work I'd heard about in New Orleans back in the 1960s. But I decided to ask a very basic question. If you have a brand new global epidemic that nobody's ever seen before, and they're telling you that it's caused by a mutated monkey virus, then the obvious logical question is, who was mutating monkey viruses and why? And what is characteristic of this whole discussion of AIDS is just massive amounts of misinformation, much of which is ridiculous. I mean, when this monkey virus thing came up, instead of the press saying, okay, let's get the list of people who were doing monkey virus research, particularly working in the area of with ingredients that could cause mutations, and start interviewing them concerning the activities that were going on and see if we can come to an answer to this. What we got instead were these ridiculous comments about people, the kinky sex theory, and people having sex with monkeys in Africa and stuff as some possible cause of this thing. And that just shows how far off the conversation. We're talking about non-commercial radio. I mean, it's why you need an alternate channel of information so that you can ask the questions, who was mutating monkey viruses and why, and get into this whole history of the development of genetic recombination and the activities that happened before genetic recombination, which led to its development, because it didn't just happen overnight. And there's a reason that the whole study of genetic recombination emerged from the study of a monkey virus, particularly the SV40 virus, which was indigenous to the Asian macaques. Now, what I did is my book is really an investigation into the murder of a cancer researcher that occurred 30 years ago. And it was to my great surprise that investigation led me to a very startling understanding about a cancer epidemic that we're having in the United States today. And the dimensions of this cancer epidemic is just staggering. I mean, it's 500, it's four cancers, first of all. They're all soft tissue cancers. We're talking about breast cancer, prostate cancer, lymphoma, and melanoma of the skin. And there's about 500,000 cases a day, and it's costing us about $250 million a day of medical insurance premiums just to take care of the clinical treatment of this, plus, of course, an absolute fortune in human suffering. Now, my investigation initially started investigating this claim that this murdered cancer researcher had been involved with a violent political extremist and had been doing some sort of bizarre viral cancer research in an underground laboratory hidden in a residential neighborhood. And the final outcome of my investigation in this thing has come to the fact that the death of this woman was not a psychosexual slashing as it had been presented to the public, but actually she died in some form of industrial accident involving a machine which produced radiation, which was being used in these monkey virus experiments in New Orleans. And so what my book is an investigation into this whole environment and to these people. And when you talk about names like Fort Detrick and you talk about the history of biological warfare development and you go back in the 1940s, 1950s, the people involved in this laboratory in New Orleans in the 1960s are people that have paper trails all the way back there, who have long histories of secret government operations, who have personal contacts with not only the people in the power structure, but they have personal stories about their family members and stuff that have been consumed by these diseases. And particularly, we investigated a document that was found in the apartment of this violent political extremist that everybody had said he wrote. Well, looked for it for a year and a half and finally found it in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and did a very detailed analysis of this document and figured out who wrote this document, who had to write
this
it.
This was David Ferry? Yeah. Ed, if I could ask you just